10:04 in Seattle. The Crusader for Common Sense, Dave Ross, is off on vacation this week. I'm Paul Harris, happy that he leaves the microphone in my hands, or at least in front of my face, while I fill in for him. And happy to have you listening to News Talk 97.3 Cairo FM. This morning I want to introduce you to Eric Bollert. Eric has got a terrific new book out now called Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press. He's a senior fellow for Media Matters for America, a former writer for Salon and Rolling Stone, writes extensively about media and politics. Eric, welcome to News Talk 97.3 Cairo FM.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And I really enjoyed your book, too.
I appreciate it.
Let's talk a little bit about how the blogosphere affected the election of Barack Obama and national politics in 2008, which is the central thesis of your book. And I want to start, if I could, with why it's the liberal blogosphere,
yeah. And
why conservatives haven't grasped the concept of net roots, as you call them.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, for years, almost decades, you know, liberals and progressives looked at with envy at what Republicans and conservatives had been able to grow on AM talk radio, and they couldn't figure out why liberals wouldn't gravitate to that sort of format, and was it something in the DNA that they just weren't as interested in, and they were envious, not so much of the message that the talk radio was putting out, but they were sort of jealous of this national platform. I mean, there was a 2007 study that found like 90% of syndicated talk in the country now is conservative. So, but now the sort of tables have been turned, and it's conservatives who look at the blogosphere and sort of scratch their heads and they say, you know, what is it about that liberal DNA that sort of made them so much more successful and really want to get in there and get online and sort of mix it up and sort of have this, you know, at times sort of chaotic and organic movement. And I argue in the book that, you know, conservatives, when the blogosphere sort of came into being at the beginning of this decade, they took more of a traditional top-down pundit approach. They were sort of very much like AM talk radio, conservative talk radio, where they were going to sort of pontificate and tell the people, you know, what was important or why Democrats were so awful and do lots of name-calling. And, you know, up until a couple of years ago, the main conservative, the blogs and sites, they didn't even have reader comments. It really was sort of a top-down approach, whereas the liberal approach was much more interactive, much more sort of organic. It was a bit messier at times because it was more like herding cats and trying to get people, you know, to coalesce around priorities or arguments. But over time, that sort of chaotic approach generated an extraordinary amount of momentum and growth, and I think it's safe to say they've completely surpassed what conservatives have been able to do online. I mean, a quick point, I mean, if you just look at the Obama and McCain campaign, I mean, those look like campaigns run from different decades. I mean, you know, Obama sort of was the Google and John McCain was the CompuServe. I mean, it was just very dramatic in terms of where the parties were and what they could do online.
It's funny you mention that because the very first online service I used when I got my very first PC in 1986, was CompuServe with nothing but text on the screen and waiting at 300 baud. That's how slow things were then. So that's
right, and it's sort of, I mean, that's where the McCain campaign was, and that was a McCain campaign that was still very much built around AM talk radio and conservative talk radio. And the Obama campaign was just, again, a different decade, you know, into a different century.
So explain to me how the Obama campaign kind of embraced this online world. We'll get to the bloggers themselves in a minute, but how were they so effective at using the Internet to get their message out?
What they did that was really groundbreaking was they completely embraced sort of the social networking aspects of the Internet. And it was no accident that they recruited Chris Hughes, who was one of the co-founders of Facebook. He was 24 years old, just out of Harvard, where he helped create Facebook as a sophomore at Harvard. And he brought that Facebook technology to the Obama campaign and created something called MyBarackObama.com. And it did the similar thing as Facebook did. You know, in the past, when campaigns had websites, you know, that's where you went to sort of learn about the agenda, and that's where you went to give money, or you could buy a T-shirt. But it was very much it was interactive, but just barely. What the Obama campaign did was created this whole sort of separate Facebook community and everything that goes with it, which is, you know, recruiting friends, starting up separate groups, exchanging just a massive amount of information. They gave their supporters tools that no other campaign had really done before. For instance, if in the old days, if you wanted to make calls on behalf of the campaign, you would go down to the local, you know, headquarters and sit on a long table and folding chairs with other people, and they would give you a list of phone numbers and you would make your calls. With MyBarackObama.com, once you, you know, logged on and became a supporter, they would send you a list of phone calls, and you would download to your computer, and you would make those calls from your home whenever you had time, and then you would sort of cross them off, and you would send the feedback that you got back to the Obama campaign. So it just completely opened the doors in terms of participation. Clearly, they raised more money than anyone ever thought possible online, because they really did create sort of a separate parallel online community in a way that no campaign had ever done before.
Okay, now, of course, Obama was not the only Democratic candidate last year. He had that neck-and-neck battle with Hillary Clinton for so many months. How were they at dealing with the blogosphere?
Well, it's interesting. They both sort of had their moments. I mean, the Obama campaign in December 2007, January 2008, just as the big race contest for the primary race were approaching, he was able to tap into the Internet to raise enough money to be competitive with an establishment candidate like Hillary Clinton from the get-go. Previous campaign cycles, he wouldn't have been able to really tap into that kind of money. So he was able to position himself financially to be able to take on Hillary Clinton head-to-head at the outset of the primaries. Hillary Clinton, after she lost, I think it was 12 out of 13, you know, in February and March, that's when she, ironically, was able to really embrace the Internet and got and received authentic grassroots support, because just like Obama traditionally wouldn't have had access to the money he got at the beginning of the campaign, traditionally if you lose 12 out of 13 races, all your money dries up and you have no sort of established outlets for cash. But the Clinton campaign, that's when they were able to turn to the Internet, and their grassroots supporters supported that campaign, kept it alive for at least two or three more months. So they both sort of at different times were able to tap into at least money via the Internet in a way that previous campaign cycles never were.
Did any of the other politicians, Democrat or Republican, have any similar kind of a success? I know they couldn't have done it on the scale that Obama did.
Yeah, right. Nobody.
Were any of the other Democrats?
Yeah, you know, the interesting Ron Paul, the Libertarian and Republican who ran, he really made he created the first online headlines in late 2007 when his supporters set off what they call a money bomb, and in one day raised $6 million. I mean, that was pre-Obama money, and at the time it was just absolutely shocking that you could raise that much money in one day, and that Ron Paul, who the Beltway, you know, establishment didn't really consider a very serious candidate, that Ron Paul could do it. The irony was, here's the only Republican, really, in the whole election cycle that figured out how to use the Internet in any sort of effective or savvy way. And the Republican Party basically wanted nothing to do with him, and he was completely ostracized for his anti-war message. So he was probably the third, he was sort of a footnote compared to what you know, Obama was able to do. But he showed early on that the Internet was going to change the landscape in important ways.
Interesting. you know, you talk in the book about how this didn't just happen in a month or even in a year, that it started because some of these liberal activists online really were upset with the Bush presidency, particularly with his reelection in 2004. And so they set out to do pretty much what they did to get a Democrat elected in 2008. Do you think that there's anyone in the GOP who got the message through Obama's success, or who will read your book and have the light bulb go off over their head and go, we got to start working on this now for 2012?
Well, a lot of people are thinking about it and want to work on it, but here's the problem with the conservatives. They are saddled with sort of this Rush Limbaugh approach, which is, if you read the conservative blogs, it's, you know, it's going to sound partisan because I come from a liberal perspective and I, you know, wrote a book sort of celebrating the liberal blogosphere, but you can't read these conservative blogs and really take them seriously. It really is sort of this Fox News, Rush Limbaugh approach, where it's really just sort of rampant misinformation and name-calling and invective and trashing people. And it's really not a serious discussion. It's really not a serious political movement. So, yes, people on the right, and I know people want to, they can, it can be done, but they... No one right now is powerful enough or willing to sort of break the chains with the right-wing blogs who do the same thing that AM Talk Radio does, because that, to me, is just sort of a recipe for a minority status, not only for the Republican Party, but for, you know, an online community. So they're really saddled, and they're saddled with this really, you know, intellectually dishonest approach that, as far as I, from my perspective. And until there's a movement online among Republicans to distance themselves from that sort of name-calling stuff, then I don't think they're going to make any headway, and they're not going to be taken seriously. And again, for them, this is sort of the online is sort of now paying for the sins of AM Talk Radio, and they've sort of morphed into that just, you know, what we on the left call the sort of Republican noise machine.
Eric Bollard's book is Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press. It's on sale now at fine bookstores and, frankly, probably some lousy bookstores, and certainly in the online world, and I'm sure the blogosphere is writing about it as we speak. We'll come back and talk about some of the bloggers who became online superstars as the Dave Ross Show continues with Paul Harris in a moment. I hear on News Talk 97.3 Cairo FM. This is News Talk 97.3 Cairo FM. Paul Harris filling in for Dave Ross and talking with Eric Bollard about a terrific new book he's written called Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press, about how the liberal blogosphere was such an important part of the 2008 presidential election and how the net roots have been propping up the Democratic Party in a way that hadn't been done until just a few years ago. Eric, let's talk about some of the people who have become online celebrities or names, or tell me who are some of the more influential members of the liberal blogosphere.
Well, you know, the biggest still and largest and most influential is still Daily Kos out in Berkeley, California, which was founded in 2002 by Marcos, and he was actually a reader of another landmark site in 2002, MyDD, which was founded by Jerome Armstrong, and the whole movement was really created by accident. As I write in the book, it was probably the least thought out, least planned political or media movement in America. I mean, there really was it really was sort of this accidental empire. There was certainly no money behind it. There's still very little money behind it. A lot of these people still do it part time, and if they do it full time, you know, they're really not making very much money. There was no, you know, there were no consultants and no publicists, and it was all very organic, and it was done because of this deep-seated frustration among, you know, liberals and progressives. I mean, they were really basically just tired of throwing things at the television. They did it during impeachment. They did it during the Florida recount, and then here they see, you know, the country gearing up for war in 2002, and they just. They really just started writing for their own sanity so they could, you know, get this stuff off their chest. And what they really wanted to do is produce a a place where liberal, sort of traditional liberal agenda was being addressed. They didn't really see it on television. So they were frustrated with Bush and the war, but they were also frustrated with the Democratic Party, and they were also frustrated with the press. And those were the sort of three main driving forces behind the creation of what, again, was really sort of this accidental media and political movement.
You talk about the fact that many of these people are doing it, it sounds like, out of passion.
Yes.
Not just desperation, but also passion for whatever their cause or agenda may be. But they're not making money at it. So how are they supporting themselves?
Well, some of the early sort of pioneers, the ones that got there and got the sort of the shoreline property, I mean, they're using a traditional media model, which is you attract enough eyeballs to your site, and then you know you can turn around and charge advertisers. The problem with the bloggers is advertisers don't pay nearly as much to reach those eyeballs online as they do for, you know, radio or your ears in that case, or newspapers or television. So even though some of these sites have, you know, readerships that rival local newspapers, they're only earning a fraction. Some still, again, just sort of do it part-time or on the weekend or after the kids go to bed. Some are able to get grants or fellowships. Some also do some political work or consultants and things like that. So they're sort of in, you know, they're in that atmosphere, or they work for, you know, nonprofits or things like that. But it really is for the it's amazing growth in the last decade. It really is rather fragile economically, and which I know it concerns not only the people doing it, but the people who want to see it continue to grow and be an outlet for liberalism in America.
One of the things that I've seen the growth of in the last few years, and since you're at Media Matters for America or involved with them, you're very familiar with this, is the notion of using these blogs and these websites as fact checkers, and then to expose and, pardon me for using the word, exploit even the most minor error that somebody on the other side makes.
Well, the old joke about the Internet is, you know, someone said something wrong on the Internet. I mean, it's this endless, you know, argument, and some people are just become, you know, you can go find any mistake you want that's out there on the Internet. But I think what you're talking about might be sort of this the role of the media critic, and the way they really do shine sort of this very bright spotlight on the press. And, you know, I think that has been a defining role that they've played. You know, for years, you know, media criticism was sort of, you know, it was done by academics and, you know, at university journals that would come out, you know, four times a year. And there were a handful of mainstream writers who wrote about the press. But with the blogger sphere, it just sort of unleashed this whole new generation of media watchdogs. And I think they've been, you know, incredibly insightful and have really held the press to a new standard. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons the press isn't particularly enamored with the liberal blogosphere, and I don't think has given it enough time and or attention and credit that it deserves. But there's no doubt that, again, sort of one of the hallmark activities of the blogosphere is just sort of old-fashioned media criticism and pointing out, you know, if facts are wrong, if there's missing context, if the press is basically simply repeating, you know, Republican talking points and treating it as news. And it's really part of a whole Netroots movement to try to hold the press accountable.
Eric, if you have time, I'd like to hold you over for another segment because there's so much to delve into here. Are you available?
Sure, sure.
All right. Eric Bollard, his book is Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press. I'm Paul Harris doing the Dave Ross Show on News Talk 97.3 Cairo FM. This is the Dave Ross Show on News Talk 97.3 Cairo FM. I'm Paul Harris. Talking about how the Internet changed politics and the press with Eric Bollard, author of the new book, Bloggers on the Bus, which is a great read, in which he talks about the popularity of the liberal blogosphere. And before the break, Eric, you were talking about how the mainstream press, the mainstream media, the MSM, as it's referred to online, has pretty much looked over its shoulder and given a big diss to a lot of these online bloggers, you know, these pundits who have made a name for themselves online, just haven't gotten the approval. You never see them showing up on the panel on Meet the Press or Face the Nation or being asked to appear in the Situation Room with Wolf Blitzer. Why is that?
Oh, no, that's very much a closed club, and the bloggers have been mocking that club for years now. So, you know, why would you turn around and invite a critic in? I will say that, I think there's a couple reasons. For years there was this Beltway mythology built up that the only way you could pontificate about politics and national politics was if you had spent, 10 or 20 years at a newspaper or had written a column and things like that. And what the blogosphere did and the internet did, it sort of swung open the doors to anyone who wanted to enter their discussion. And we've seen over time, particularly, a handful of voices on the left, people who had no connection with professional politics, no connection with professional journalism, have emerged as some of the most compelling writers and some of the most insightful commentators about American politics. So, the Beltway, there was always this very narrow career path you had to navigate. And then, at the age of 45 or 50, you got your blazer and you were sort of welcome into the club. And they sort of liked that, and it was a closed club. And again, the blogosphere has sort of been poking holes in all of that. And, the Beltway, it's called, the Beltway Press, which is sort of derogatorily known as the Village by bloggers. They still sort of control the reins, and they still have the mainstream media platform. So they're going to keep that club intact as long as they can, and I think that's one of the reasons they don't want any of these people inside. They have their club, and they'd like to keep it that way for however long they can. I mean, it's the mainstream media economically is suffering so badly. I don't think it's going to be that long, but yeah, there's a definite sort of chip on their shoulder about the blogosphere.
All right. Well, we talk about the blogosphere and its support of and the help in getting Barack Obama elected. Has this administration returned in kind the niceties towards the bloggers? Do they give them access? Do they give them seats in the White House press room?
Well, at the first press conference, Obama famously called on Sam Stein, who was a reporter for the Huffington Post. So not really a blogger in the sense of, someone who has their own site, it works at home. The Huffington Post is obviously a much larger, much more successful platform. But that was definitely a nod to the netroots and the online media that's emerging. It's interesting, the blogosphere's relationship with Obama, even during the campaign, was probably a little more nuanced and complicated than most people thought. Obama was sort of generally known as the internet candidate. What he did, Obama was able to win over the internet, but he pretty much left the blogosphere alone and the bloggers. They were definitely more partisan and aggressive than as a candidate than he felt comfortable with. And he never, I think the blogosphere was hoping, they and the Obama campaign were going to sort of cross the finish line in November together. But it didn't quite work out that way, and the Obama campaign wasn't entirely comfortable with that, with the blogosphere rhetoric. So there was a distance and some tension, and as with Obama in the White House, a lot of the critics of the netroots and the bloggers said, well, they're just going to be a bunch of cheerleaders, and they're not going to hold them accountable, and they're not going to be critical. Well, anyone reading the blogosphere in the last 2 weeks have seen countless examples of where liberal writers online have been rather critical of the Obama White House, particularly over issues like the sort of reversal on not releasing the torture photos, questions about national security and Afghanistan. So the bloggers aren't going to sit on their hands, because they have never seen the blogosphere as being an appendage to the Democratic National Party. They never saw it their job to just sort of cheerlead Democratic politicians. They see the blogosphere as being an outlet for a liberal agenda, and they're gonna push for it. And when the Obama White House does things that they like, they're absolutely going to cheer and support. And when they take sort of a centrist or a right turn, they're going to critique it. And that being said, they're more than willing to play defense for Obama, and they've done that quite a bit, particularly with this sort of unhinged rhetoric we've heard from the right, attacking Obama for being a Marxist and a socialist and all that stuff. So they're absolutely willing and able to play defense. But when it comes to policy, it's pretty much the same with Bush. I mean, if the White House does something that is truly liberal, it'll get their support. And if they don't, the White House is probably going to hear about it.
Let's talk about one of the favorite targets of the liberal blogosphere last year. You know, the conservative media in this country, if you said the words Bill Clinton or Hillary Clinton, or nowadays I guess it's Nancy Pelosi, they were the big bullseye on the target of those media outlets. Last year, the target, while it probably should have been exclusively on John McCain, shifted in August when McCain named Governor Sarah Palin as his running mate. And wow, did that put the fire on high for the liberal blogosphere. Do you think that at times they got a little bit out of control with their fervor for going after Sarah Palin?
Well, yeah, I mean, I have a chapter in the book about Palin and the blogs. It was sort of good news, bad news from the liberal blogosphere. If you look up at Alaska, there was a handful of liberal bloggers up there who absolutely were essential in helping educate, the lower 48 about who Sarah Palin was and her real record and the Bridge to Nowhere and Troopergate and all that sort of important stories that I think the press would have got to eventually, but they were able to put it out there right from day one because they knew. I mean, they literally knew her. I mean, they had conversations with her. She used to be their mayor, and it's Alaska's one big small town, so they had real insight on that. The downside was this conspiracy theory got birthed, no pun, online about how Sarah Palin had faked, the birth of her son Trigg, and that it wasn't really her son.
Yeah, that's an example of where I think things went a little bit too crazy.
Oh yeah, I go into this in great detail in the book, and this conspiracy theory that it was her son's her daughter's son, and she was covering for her because she was unwed, and I think it definitely became a black eye. There's no question it became a black eye for the blogosphere, and conservatives really jumped on that and said, they're being vicious and they're being personal, and this is completely out of bounds. The thing that I pointed out in the book is that it really wasn't the bloggers who did that. It was their very overexcited readers and diarists and people who they don't really have control over. I mean, one of the things we talked about earlier is this phenomenal growth. One of the phenomenal growth comes from bloggers don't really restrain their community other than, obviously, offensive, language or making personal attacks. The conversation goes where it goes. It's sort of like blaming a talk radio host for having callers who keep calling in and want to talk about some conspiracy theory that the host doesn't want to talk about. That's sort of what happened here. Some diarists at Daily Coast really got this story going and claimed there was photographic evidence, and there's no question it was embraced among readers who that first weekend when Sarah Palin was announced were frankly freaking out that she was maybe going to be the game changer and she was going to help elect John McCain. And I think too many people sort of embraced it. And the fact is that those diaries, the Daily Coast, got emailed to all the major bloggers, but none of them touched it. In fact, some of them emailed the readers back and saying, look, I'm not going to go out. You show me some facts, I'll write about it. I'm not just going to float this. This is a smear. And eventually it was Daily Coast community itself which debunked the story. But it probably happened a little too late, and it happened by the time it got debunked. The blogosphere sort of had a black eye because the critics were claiming that the bloggers had done it. But if you wanted to be technical about it was really their over-anxious and over-partisan readers who sort of let that get out of control. So, I interviewed someone in the book who was trying to debunk it furiously, and he said, look, it's one of the examples, with freedom comes responsibility. And that was an example, I think, where things, just because of such a hothouse atmosphere and there was so much attention being paid, that things probably got a little bit out of control.
You used a couple of words in there, vicious and personal. I can tell you as a person who's been online with a website and a blog for a long, long time that there are some readers, and frankly, I don't understand why some of these people who apparently hate me so much keep checking my website, and by the way, have a comment posted 90 seconds after I put something up. I mean, it's like they've got some sort of Google alert that lets them know as soon as I post something, and boom, they've got to come back. And some of that is vicious, and some of it is personal. Now, I'm kind of thick-skinned because I've been in this business, the radio business, for a long, long time, and so those kind of attacks have kind of become part and parcel of what you have to deal with. But I will say that perhaps the anonymity of the online experience has made some people forget that they're dealing with another human being. Do you think that sometimes that crosses the line, not just in that social networking community, but with the bloggers themselves?
Well, I don't think with the bloggers themselves. I mean, some of the key bloggers didn't write under their real name, and there are still lots of them who do that. But I think it's much more of a phenomenon among the readers and the commenters. And there's no question, particularly if you go back to the campaign season, whether it was the primary campaign or the general election campaign, that some of this, it's just sort of completely unhinged, I guess is the way to put it.
That's a good word for it.
And it was very hateful and lots of name-calling and things like that. And, you know, and the bloggers, I think, sort of look at their community. Obviously, they're happy to have a following because without the readers, it's not going to be anything. But I'm sure they read some of the comments and sort of wonder what it's all about. But I think the anonymity among the commenters definitely adds to the sense of just sort of a brawling atmosphere. But again, it seems to be mostly, at least within the liberal blogosphere, it really did seem to be tied in specifically to campaigns. And once the campaigns, either the Democratic primary or the general election ended, the rhetoric seemed to return a bit more to normalcy.
Eric, it's a terrific book. I really enjoyed it, and thanks for your time here today.
Oh, I appreciate it, and anytime.
Yeah, the book is called Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press. We'll put a link up on my website, harrisonline.com, and on mynorthwest.com if you're interested in getting a copy and can't find it somewhere in the Seattle area. Eric Bollard here on the Dave Ross Show with Paul Harris on News Talk 97.3 Cairo FM.